The MMQB podcast is brought to you by FanDuel, the leader in one-week fantasy football, with more winners and more payouts than any other site. Enter promo code THEMMQB at FanDuel.com for a bonus match of up to $200. We're also sponsored by the SeatGeek app, the easiest way to find a great deal, pay for your ticket, and get to your seat. Download the app and enter our code MMQB for $20 off your first tickets.
The whole league's based on bounties. It's just a matter of whether you pay it in cash and $5 bills or in $1 million checks. You know, in college, I accidentally took microeconomics 2 times in a row and didn't notice it till the final.
What?
And it hit me on the final. Like halfway through the final, I saw something and I thought, well, it's a lot like last year's final.
I'm Robert Klimko of the MMQB. My co-host is fellow writer for the MMQB, Andy Benoit. Today, we'll be breaking down several of the most important games of the year as we whittle down the playoff contenders and in a new segment discussing some of the news and notes from the week. So let's jump right into it. There's no Miami Dolphins game to preview this week because they're coming off the London game and thus get the bye that one rightfully deserves after making that trip. But they have a lot to deal with this week. They fired head coach Joe Philbin. Dan Campbell, the 39-year-old tight ends coach, is promoted to replace him. This is not necessarily a surprise when you see these interim coaching situations. Often the offensive coordinator or defensive coordinator is not the one promoted. Presumably they've been doing a pretty bad job if the head coach is getting fired. And it's very difficult to promote a play caller to head coach and then ask somebody else to be play caller or ask that person who's going to be head coach to continue to do the play calling. So young, charismatic, former NFL tight end becomes the head coach. We don't see him as a head coaching candidate for them in 2016, but perhaps if he has a turnaround season here. The big surprise to me, Andy, is that they do not go ahead and fire defensive coordinator Kevin Coyle as well. There was talk that he would be on the chopping block too, but he remains. Supposedly or presumably him and Dan Campbell will be having meetings on how to revive what has been a lackluster defense despite the signing of Ndamukong Suh. Your thoughts, Andy?
Yeah, it has been lackluster in a variety of ways. A few thoughts here. For one, it's a good point about play calling. I think you keep the play callers in their position because that's the best way to maintain the type of continuity you need. Obviously, you're wanting to shake things up if you're changing your head coach, but that doesn't mean you shake up the game plans and the playbooks each week because you don't have time to learn all this stuff all over again. Campbell's a tight end coach too, and something to keep in mind, tight ends are so versatile anymore and the way they're used. And those coaches, tight end coaches, have to be up on what the offensive line is doing, up on, to a certain degree, what the running backs are doing, and obviously up on what the wide receivers are doing. So if ever there's a position to move a guy from position coach to head coach, you could argue tight end coach is most conducive to that. So I'll be eager to see how this works out. Joe Philbin is not Miami's lone problem here, though. They've got a lot of exploitable weaknesses on the field, issues on offensive line and cornerback. And those two positions are exactly the type you can specifically go after, opponents can go after. So it's not a quick fix for Miami right now.
Yeah. I wanted to go into one thing that came out after Joe Philbin was fired. And every time a coach is fired in midseason, then leaks begin coming out about why and how things were so bad. This was kind of a peculiar one. Ryan Tannehill supposedly tells practice squad players after intercepting him during a Saturday walkthrough, enjoy your practice squad paycheck, enjoy your practice squad trophy. This was troubling to me for a couple of reasons as a report, because it was very vague. The report was by Aaron Wilson with the National Football Post. It's 5 graphs. Discusses a Saturday walkthrough. No context as to how hard guys are supposed to play during Saturday walkthroughs. Maybe this is something that would just pass by and you'd never hear about it if this team weren't in this situation. But then when people start digging for symptoms of dysfunction, this is the sort of thing that comes out. I'm not saying that Aaron Wilson doesn't know his stuff. I'm not saying that he was wrong to report this, but I think that there's more context needed. And I was surprised that in the couple of days after that story came out, more wasn't added to the narrative.
Yeah, I agree with you. I was a little taken aback by that as well. I've heard follow-up reports that say the Dolphins defensive players, practice squad guys, weren't supposed to be going hard in that scenario. And as Tannehill started running his mouth, other guys on defense started going harder. And, you know, Pro Football Talk tried to equate that to an example of Joe Philbin losing control. The reality is, that's all hindsight stuff. And if the Dolphins were undefeated, you could say, hey, look how hard their practice squad guys are. Look how competitive they are. We don't have context for any of this stuff. I'm sure Ryan Tannehill's not the first quarterback to trash talk out of frustration against a practice squad guy and make fun of him for being a practice squad guy. So I don't put a lot of stock into that. What we can know and what we have seen is on the field when these games count, not in the walkthrough, Miami has also looked ill-prepared at times.
Yeah, and you mentioned ill-prepared, and what's been glaring to me is the big deficiency along the defensive line, not because it's the worst-performing position group on the team, but just because that was supposed to be their strong suit. I mean, they've invested $111 million currently in those contracts, and those guys have allowed 642 rushing yards, the most in the NFL this season, and recorded just one sack. I think we've gone into the troubles of Sue on this podcast, but I'm curious for your take on why Cameron Wake hasn't been able to put up the numbers.
Yeah, and I agree with you. It's not the most disappointing, or I guess it's probably most disappointing. It's not the worst unit, but it's the most underachieving unit in Miami. And I don't know the answer on Cameron Wake. He has not shown up at all. I've watched every Dolphin snap this season, and he just hasn't shown up. And when a guy doesn't get in the film notes or doesn't get in on the game notes, there's a reason for that. I mean, I've heard he's maybe not healthy, whatever it is. Even if he's not producing the sacks, Cameron Wake has always been a guy who flashes, initial burst off the edge. That hasn't been there this season. Olivier Vernon's another excellent player who just hasn't shown up or hasn't flashed. Who knows what the reasoning is for this, but it was obviously supposed to be a strength that was going to manifest into a greater strength, and it hasn't gone that way for Miami. And go back to, if you have a defensive line that's underperforming, that's the last thing you need when you have a weakness at cornerback, because obviously now there's time to throw the ball. Cornerbacks, guys like Bryce McCain, are not designed to hold up in coverage for more than 3 seconds.
A couple more topics before we jump into these games. We've got a number of high-profile players returning from suspensions this week. Greg Hardy, Rolando McClain, Sheldon Richardson, Antonio Gates in San Diego, Martavis Bryant in Pittsburgh. I mean, these are veritable stars in the NFL who were part of that big wave of early suspensions. If you could take a look here at the five of these guys that I mentioned, could you pick one or two out that may have the biggest impacts on their teams going forward?
I think Hardy will have the biggest impact because of his versatility as a pass rusher and what he's going to do for what's really a high energized but not necessarily particularly talented Cowboys D-line. They have a chance to be a pretty good defensive line in that scheme with him in it. The one that scares me the most, if I'm thinking about having to play against these guys, Martavis Bryant, because you don't need to change what you're doing to incorporate him. And Pittsburgh's already been very productive offensively. They've looked wide open. I know Roethlisberger's out right now, but you're talking about adding more speed, in fact, better speed than they already have, to what's already the most difficult, one of the most difficult receiving cores and passing games to match up against.
He adds speed, not to mention size. I mean, this guy is 6'4", 215 pounds, 26 catches last year in just 3 starts, 549 yards, and 8 touchdowns. I think everybody and their mom had him as their breakout player of the year, and yet he gets suspended for substance abuse, and all those fantasy owners had to wait.
They do have to wait, and I'm surprised you've waited this long. In fact, you haven't brought it up. I'm bringing it up to remind us that you saw Martavis Bryant at your trip to Jay Glazer's gym this summer.
I didn't actually see him. I wrote
that you said he'd been there, though.
That he had been there, and I've moved past the Jay Glazer story.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, it was like 7 or 8 shows in a row, I think. I think our first 7 or 8 podcasts that you worked it in there. I saw Chris Johns. I watched the Cardinals game this weekend, and every time I saw Chris Johnson handle the ball, my first thought was, I can't believe how impressed Klimko is that the guy got shot. And you saw him at that gym working out with a bullet in him.
Yeah, that's right. Well, no, I didn't actually see him there either. I was there on a day when not a lot of guys were there.
Oh, well, you sure? Boy, that's a lot of name dropping for guys not in attendance.
Let's move on to our third topic before we hit the games. Trent Dilfer and Ray Lewis slammed Jimmy Graham's blocking during Sunday Night Football. Or no, that was last night. That was Monday Night Football. Trent Dilfer said, he's a fantastic offensive weapon when split out. Jimmy Graham, of course, the tight end for the Seattle Seahawks, whom they traded Max Unger and a first-round pick for. But when he's an inline tight end, Dilfer says, it's not perception, it is fact. He is unwilling and incapable to hold up in the run game. He's more of a spectator than a blocker. They're averaging 0 yards per carry when he lines up as an inline tight end. And then Ray Lewis adds, he's a queen tight end. He's the opposite of what I was used to be playing against. Setting aside the harmful, heteronormative, misogynistic insults coming from Ray Lewis, are they accurate in the notion that Jimmy Graham is just a horrible blocking tight end?
Well, that was the concern with him. I'd heard other players. I actually spent time with Tyrann Mathieu watching Jimmy Graham on film. That's going to come out in a few weeks. And this was prior to the season. And that was the first thing he said. I was a little surprised he said it on the record. And other guys have since said it on the record. Look, Jimmy Graham has not been asked to do that a lot in his career. It's a different approach for him. I didn't interpret, and I didn't see this. I've only seen in print. But I didn't interpret Ray Lewis's comments as anything hetero or homosexual related. I thought what he meant by that is a queen like a chess piece that moves around the board in large chunks and rather than, I mean, there's no chess piece for a blocker. But I think that's what he meant by that is Jimmy Graham as a finesse chess piece type of guy. Which would fit what Dilfer was saying with him splitting out or playing the slot or wherever, which, by the way, Seattle has not done with Jimmy Graham. They've treated Graham like any other tight end. In week three against Chicago, we talked about this last week. They did make a deliberate effort to get him the ball, but it was no different than any other tight end. It's almost like they think they've got a super version of Luke Wilson in there. What they need to be doing is treating Graham like Jimmy Graham and dictating mismatches with him by lining him up, like, I think, as a queen-type chess piece.
Yeah. Well, I do apologize then if I've mischaracterized Mr. Lewis's words. I read it a different way.
Yeah, no, and you can absolutely see how it would come out that way. And someone at ESPN maybe told Ray Lewis, hey, you know, just be mindful of this, because if you're talking about blocking and what Ray Lewis was referring to, there's an implied sense of manhood with it and toughness and old school grit. And, you know, to call it queen the next thing and imply his finesse, it's not the best choice of words.
Yeah. And before we move on, you know, I wrote about this. The idea that Jimmy Graham is being misused a couple of weeks ago after the Packers game, when their Packers defensive line, including B.J. Raji and Mike Neal, absolutely tore them up. And I think it limited a lot of the plans that they have had for Jimmy Graham in the slot, and it forced him to be an inline tight end on a lot of play-action passes and waggles and bootlegs and things like that. So I think it's as much a function of what a lack of creativity on the part of Daryl Bevel as it is some of their deficiencies on other parts of the offense.
Yes, it could be. And something else to keep in mind, kind of along those lines, Jimmy Graham also must adjust to Seattle and what they do. It's not like this offense hasn't had a form of success with their style of play, and it's a very unique style of play. We saw that game Monday night, and it's not breaking news. Almost the entire Seahawks passing game takes place out of structure. It's Wilson breaking things down and making something happen. That is the opposite approach of what Graham grew used to in New Orleans with Drew Brees, who plays a game like a computerized quarterback almost.
Yeah. Wanted to thank you guys again for joining the MMQB podcast. Before we move on and tell you a little bit about our sponsor, SeatGeek, they're giving our listeners $20 when they use the code MMQB. A $20 check with your name on it, and there's no catch. You download the SeatGeek app on your iPhone or Android. It's free and takes less than a minute to download. Then you search for your event, find the deal you want, enter our code MMQB, and when you complete your purchase, SeatGeek will send a $20 check to your house. Even if you pick a seat that's less than $20, they will still send the full check. That means SeatGeek is paying you to use their service. SeatGeek pulls in tickets options from hundreds of sellers online and shows you the best deals automatically. So to redeem your promo code and get $20 off, download the free SeatGeek app today. Enter your promo code MMQB in the app. SeatGeek will then send you $20 once you've made your first purchase. If you want to go see the NFL, college football, or the best concerts, use the SeatGeek app and enter our code MMQB to save $20. So we've lined up the top five games, or what we surmise are the most competitive and interesting and relevant to the playoff conversation this week. Want to jump right in here. First of all, the teams that have bye weeks, as we mentioned before, the Dolphins, the Jets, the Vikings, and the Panthers. Two teams that are not on a bye, the Seahawks and Bengals. The Bengals are a surprising 4-0. The Seattle Seahawks are 2-2, rebounding from an 0-2 start quite nicely with the help of a pretty mediocre second half of the first month of the season schedule. Andy Dalton for the Bengals, in four straight games, he has a 115 or greater quarterback rating. I don't think anybody saw this coming. Obviously, it has a lot to do with the performance of A.J. Green. But against the blitz this year, Dalton is 15 of 28 for 337 yards and three touchdowns. Not a guy who struggles in the regular season, but really not a guy who has performed at this level in regular seasons past.
No, he's playing the best football of his career right now, no question about that. You know, he looks like a guy who's been in relatively the same system now for 4 years, going on his fifth. He looks very comfortable with what they're doing, and he's had different offensive coordinators, but Hugh Jackson has not changed a lot in Cincy, and I think they've done a very good job of putting Dalton in favorable situations. I know last week against the Chiefs, for example, for one, they were excellent picking up the blitzes, and for two, they didn't have to pick up a lot of blitzes because they had success throwing on early downs. They spread out wide and really put those Chiefs defensive backs on an island, and those guys in Kansas City are struggling on the back end. They did the same kind of thing to Baltimore the previous week. The Bengals right now are doing as good a job as any team in the league at exploiting their opponent's weaknesses through game plan, and Dalton has been the guy overseeing all of that, and he's playing with tremendous confidence because of it.
Yeah, it's one of the things that makes Hugh Jackson, I think, one of the top two or three head coaching candidates in the NFL. As offensive coordinator, wherever he goes, he seems to be able to adapt the offense to best fit the personnel. I mean, I remember in Oakland when he was there under Tom Cable, that offense was nearly the opposite of this one. I mean, it was a running back centric passing game, a power running game. Whereas here, the Bengals are spreading out the field and using some of the weapons they have on the outside.
Yeah, he does a good job. I agree with you. And he's got a lot of different weapons to use. They can play a lot of different brands of football in Cincy because of the types of different weapons they have in the passing game. And they have a reliable offensive line. And an offensive line that has size and can also move pretty well. A lot of their run designs were outside stretch or edge handoffs with double pull blockers. That's pretty good versatility for a team that's known to go straight downhill.
Seattle's defensive struggles were well documented when Cam Chancellor was out of the lineup while holding out. With him in the lineup in these last two games, they've gone up against the offense 20 times, 20 drives. They've forced 18 punts, one fumble, one field goal. Still no interceptions, but I think those come with time. I mean, they had a couple opportunities against Detroit that were bobbled. But I think his impact on this team, not only emotionally, just what they're able to do in terms of scheme, is very clear after only 2 weeks.
Yeah, it's almost like as if he's a guy worth paying a lot of money to. He is a difference maker because of how their zones are structured and the versatility he gives them in the zone coverages. He can play staggered, meaning he doesn't have to line up deep or shallow. He's very adjustable. He's you could argue he's their most important piece in a lot of ways from a down-to-down basis. There might be guys in critical moments who are more important, like an Earl Thomas or even a Richard Sherman or some of those pass rushers. But as the centerpiece for what they do, Chancellor gets them from snap to snap as effectively as anybody.
Before we move on to Patriots and Cowboys, I wanted to talk a little bit about Monday night's game, Seahawks against Detroit. You saw Russell Wilson sacked six times. He lost two fumbles. They probably could have sacked him a number of more times, but he was able to elude the rush. That was one of the worst offensive line performances I've seen out of a Seattle team. And what surprised me was that the pressure wasn't just coming from up the middle. I mean, Ziggy Ansah especially was getting after it on the outside.
He was, and he was going against their best pass blocker, Russell Okung. Something to keep in mind, Russell Wilson's always, and this sounds counterintuitive, but he's always going to make his linemen look worse than they are to a certain degree because of his style. He covers so much ground, he runs around, he extends plays even if he doesn't necessarily have to.
Well this is the old Vic problem where all those offensive linemen said that they took, you know, months and years off of their careers because they're running around trying to compensate for him.
Yeah, it's hard to block for a moving QB because blocking is all about protecting a home base. Blitzes are designed to attack a pocket passer, therefore pass protections are designed to protect a pocket passer. Your back is to the quarterback when you're blocking. We forget that. And so if he's moving around, it's harder to do your job effectively. Now, he's also going to cover some of your mistakes. It's a give and take with Wilson. I think it's his style of play is worth it overall, although we saw cases on Monday night where he could have easily had more turnovers. There was some loose ball handling there. So it's, look, Seattle, because of this, they're always going to be inconsistent. Their O-line's always going to look up and down, bad at times, but they're going to also win games that really they probably shouldn't be winning, and I think we saw all of that happen Monday night. Wilson does need more help from those guys up front, though. Just because he's not a pocket passer doesn't mean that he can survive this kind of season if he's under that kind of siege all game long.
Patriots at Cowboys. The Patriots are 3-0. They had one of those early week four byes that everybody dreads.
Yeah, they're so good right now. I'm surprised they didn't somehow get a win on their bye week.
The Cowboys are 2-2. Lance Dunbar now joins the long list of Cowboys out for the year. There were memes passing around the other day that this week's sign of the apocalypse is Darren McFadden being the only healthy Dallas Cowboy.
That's not nice. That's not nice to Darren McFadden.
At the beginning of the podcast, we mentioned that both Greg Hardy and Rolando McClain returned this week. We talked about Hardy and his impact. Does Rolando McClain get plugged in right into the lineup and have a big impact as well?
No, because Sean Lee's back. I know he had a concussion last week, but let's look at the macro picture. Sean Lee's their linebacker, and Anthony Hitchens is their other linebacker. And anymore, you play nickel, not base 4-3. McClain does not move well in space. He's not a consistent guy in space, and he's probably not going to get a lot of snaps in nickel. So I wouldn't expect him to play more than one-third of the snaps in a game, maybe 45% on depending on their opponent. It will not be this week. They're going to have to play nickel against New England.
What a world we live in where a concussion is not considered part of the macro picture.
I didn't follow that, actually. I don't know what you're talking about. And even though what's embarrassing is you use my words, and I already felt like I was going out on a limb saying macro. You know, in college, I accidentally took microeconomics 2 times in a row and didn't notice it till the final.
What?
And it hit me on the final, like halfway through the final. I saw something and I thought, well, it's a lot like last year's final. And then I was like that drop feeling, you know. It was actually, I took it in high school as a senior and then a freshman.
Yeah.
So I regret using macro and micro at all in my verbiage. It's not going to happen again. Sean Lee's better than Rolando McClain, though. That's what I'm saying.
That is embarrassing, Andy.
It was humiliating. It was because I knew. I'm away at college, so I knew not only have I done it twice, but I have to go report this to a lot of people. I have to go tell the guidance counselor, whoever like is in charge of setting your schedule, I guess the academic assistant. I'd have to tell my parents at some point. There was just no way around it. So I got to look forward to that it did make the test easier, though. I didn't feel any pressure in the second half of that test.
So at some point, some of the blame has to go on the counselor for double booking you in the class.
At some point, but doesn't the blame go with the student who, it's not like I got there and waited a week and thought, oh, wait a minute. I waited I didn't notice until the end of the semester.
Yeah.
The very end.
Getting back to the football, even with the bye factored in, New England has scored the fourth most points in the league with 119. That's a little bit ridiculous. I mean, they're not exactly on Peyton Manning 2013 Denver Broncos pace. But this is an offense that is not exactly spreading the ball out to a bunch of different people. I mean, it's Gronkowski, Edelman, and Tom Brady. And yet, the three teams that they face don't seem to have an answer for it.
It's amazing. And watching them on film, they play at a fast tempo, and not just before the snap, but after the snap. The ball is out quickly. Everything they do is fast. And the other wrinkle with that is Gronkowski. He's another queen type of movable tight end. And where they align him dictates often where they align the wide receivers. And they do a better job of getting receivers matched on linebackers than any team in the league. And that's how Edelman, who's not very big, and he's moderately fast, but he's not a burner. That's how he's so productive, is when you match Edelman up against a wide receiver and a linebacker, he's going to look like Jerry Rice a lot of the time.
Yeah. I don't think you will find a lot of people picking the Cowboys in that game. I think that the Patriots are expected to make this a pretty decent undefeated run here, if not all the way through.
Yeah, Dallas has no players right now. I mean, their QB's out, their most productive pass-catching running back's out, their wide receiver's out, and their offensive line has been a disappointment by its standards a year ago. That offense is really depleted.
Yeah. Moving on, Rams at Packers. The Packers on a similar tear like the one that we talked about in New England. Rodgers this season, 995 passing yards, 11 touchdowns, 0 interceptions, and a 72.4 completion percentage. Forget not throwing interceptions at home. The guy is just not throwing interceptions at all. On the other side, Todd Gurley debuts as a starter for the Rams and doesn't disappoint. 25 carries for 155 yards. For a while there, him and Tavon Austin were the only bright spots on that offense, although they got things going in the second half. But you really saw a glimpse of what the Rams' future could be with those two young players.
Yeah, Gurley looked a lot better in the second half than he did in the first half, and he looked fine in the first half, but second half you saw what people have been talking about with that guy. He ran with great spatial awareness, great understanding of what was going on in the game around him. And I'll be interested to see this week. You brought up Rodgers. San Francisco did not pressure him. They have not, and they've been a pressure team on defense this season. They very deliberately played softer zone coverages. Not the best way to go against Rodgers, but also Eric Mangini went into that game knowing there's a reason he's not going to pressure Rodgers. The Rams have been as diverse with their pressure concepts as any team this season, and if any D coordinator would have the gall to blitz a QB that no one else is blitzing, I would think it would be Greg Williams. So we're going to find out a lot about what St. Louis believes their identity to be defensively this week. I can't wait for this one because the Rams can play any style of defense they want. They choose to play very complex and aggressive attack-oriented football. If they're willing to do that against Aaron Rodgers, that will say a lot about how they feel about their guys.
And if I know Greg Kill the Head Williams, I think that he will go against the grain and try to put some pressure on the guy.
You know that Kill the Head thing? I don't think he was talking about injuring a QB's head. I think what he meant is if you can disrupt their quarterback, cut the head off the snake of the offense, the whole offense gets disrupted.
Yeah, that's all well and good, but then
it was a metaphor.
When you couple that metaphor with the whole bounty system, I mean...
Oh, but the whole league's a bounty system. Guys that get... why do you think big-time defensive hitters, why did like a Clay Matthews, why does Ryan Kerrigan, those guys, why are they getting $25 million guaranteed? That's just a more structured form of bounty. They have an ability to knock players out of games, to hit, to reach the QB. The whole league's based on bounties. It's just a matter of whether you pay it in cash and $5 bills or in $1 million checks.
You can't deny that there's some sort of added incentive to go for injury when guys are getting not only paid off book bonuses, but being lauded in this environment where giving somebody a concussion is somehow a positive thing and you're secretly celebrating it. I don't think that happens everywhere in the NFL.
But if they're talking about knocking guys out, they're not talking about, hey, you get $1,000 for an ACL. They're saying if you can hit a guy hard enough to get him out of the game.
Yeah, and the best way to do that is to damage his brain.
Well, that's okay, but that's the whole problem with football then. Now we're being Time Magazine examining the science of football.
Okay.
Football's about hitting.
Let's not be Time Magazine. Green Bay allowed 141 yards rushing to Matt Forte in week one. Since then, Marshawn Lynch gets 41, Jamal Charles gets 49, Carlos Hyde gets 20 yards. Do you have any hope for Todd Gurley and this Rams offense to run the ball? And what is it that Green Bay has done differently since that first week? Or was that first week just an aberration?
It could have been an aberration. Clay Matthews has spent more time at inside linebacker. That's helped. B.J. Raji's looking like the B.J. Raji we knew of a few years ago. That's also helped. And St. Louis, they're going to try no matter what. If they are running, they're the most run-based offense in the NFL by a wide margin. If they don't run the ball, if they don't have 25 rushing attempts in this game, probably closer to 35, there's no chance they'll win.
Okay, last two games here. Washington at Atlanta. Washington 2-2. The Falcons, another surprising 4-0. Gosh, think about the possibility of a Falcons-Bengals Super Bowl here. Who could have picked something like that?
Yeah, I picked them to win the NFC South, but I figured they'd do it with like 8 wins or something like that. NFC South, they've got a couple of 4-0 teams in there right now. Atlanta's playing well. I've been real surprised. You're not a surprise, right? You went and saw them in training camp and were pretty high on their defense. I know you wrote about Trufant before the season. You met with Dan Quinn. I'm surprised that defense has, I don't think they've turned it around completely, but they've certainly gotten going in the right direction. I'm surprised they've done that as quickly as they have.
I was high on them because I'm high on Dan Quinn as a coach and a motivator. I did not think that we'd be looking at 4-0 or a possible, 10-6 or 11-5 finish. I was in your camp at 8-8. The big surprise for them has been the rushing prowess of Devonta Freeman. How has Kyle Shanahan's zone blocking concepts complemented what Devonta does best?
Well, I think one thing that guys like me forget about coaching is there's a teaching element with it. It's not just drawing up X's and O's and outthinking the opposing coach or opposing team. The Shanahans must be very good at also teaching the mechanics of their blocking approach, because Kyle Shanahan did this in Washington. Cleveland, there was hit or miss there, but he's had a lot of success as the schemer of an offense from an execution standpoint before. And they don't have new players, not that many in Atlanta. They've got new guards, but it's the same group for the most part as last year, just playing better. And something they're also doing, they're incorporating the fullback in their lineup. And that's another thing Shanahan did in Washington, a lot of more old school running concepts. In this case, it's a fullback, and they're having great success with that. It's also helped their passing game a lot because they're not facing as many nickel packages. So Freeman, I like him a lot. I think he'll replace Coleman as the starting running back there once Coleman's healthy.
We've got a rare matchup here of two teams that are both having a lot of success on the ground and really leaning on the ground game in a lot of ways. Washington leads the league in rushing with 558 yards. I don't think many saw that coming after a sophomore slump season for Alfred Morris, but I think he's coming on strong here.
He's coming on strong. I mean, he works, he presses the hole very well as a zone runner. And so if you get the blocking in front of him, and they brought in Bill Callahan to teach the zone, there's back to the teaching concept. Bill Callahan's another guy who teaches zone blocking extremely well. They add Brandon Scherff, they put Callahan in there, and that offensive line's been better in the zone game, and Morris is a very good zone runner. The other guy, Matt Jones, of course, who wasn't very productive last week, but overall, he's their most dynamic runner. He's big, he's fast, he's just got more to offer than Morris. So this is a chance to be a really good 1-2 punch, and you have to play that way if you're Washington, because Kirk Cousins is effective when he's ahead in the down and distance, but if you ask him to drop back and make a bunch of 3rd-and-10 throws, that's where you get interceptions. Kirk Cousins.
Yeah. Last game we're going to look at, Steelers at Chargers, both teams 2-2, kind of a pivotal game early this season for both of these teams in competitive divisions. Michael Vick getting the start for the Steelers as Roethlisberger is expected to be back in 3 weeks. In 2 appearances so far this season, Vick is 24 of 32 for 162 yards, 1 touchdown, no interceptions, with his lone big highlight coming on a pretty great downfield block, though not necessarily what you want your quarterback's best play being over the course of 2 games.
Or what you want your backup quarterback with a history of injuries to be doing himself, because I can tell you for certain that Landry Jones has not been developed hardly at all in Pittsburgh. They have not slowed the bus down for him to get on board at any point in his career. So if Vic goes down, the offense goes with him because there's no one else to run it.
On the other side of the ball, Philip Rivers, Chargers quarterback at 34 years old, is leading the league in passing yards with 1,249. The Steelers have stifled the last two passing attacks they've faced, allowing 165 yards in an overtime loss at Baltimore in a game I was actually at, and 187 yards against the Rams. Not a big surprise considering that's not really a forte of St. Louis, but they have been having overall success against the pass. In this matchup of the Steelers defense led by the big defensive end Cameron Hayward, who is living up to his offseason pay raise at the moment, how do you feel Rivers stacks up against these guys?
I think he stacks up very well. I think the curtain gets pulled back on this Steelers secondary a bit this week. They play a lot of off coverage there, and San Diego does a lot of underneath quicker passes. I mean, they're gonna be a lot of 5-yard completions in this game, and it's a matter of whether the Steelers can tackle or not. And that's their approach, and maybe they can. But this is not a great secondary. It's playing very well right now. Ross Cockrell, the new nickelback, has been a pleasant surprise. I want to see someone go after William Gay, Antoine Blake, Cortez Allen when he's in there. Someone go after them hard. They really haven't been tested the last 2 weeks. Baltimore, it's a makeshift passing attack. They were without some of their key components late in that game. And St. Louis is all smoke and mirrors through the air. They don't have anyone that threatens you, really. Tavon Austin, maybe, but even he can be taken away by certain coverages.
Yeah. Well, before we move on to your Twitter questions and our non-football recommended week reading of the week that we like to close out the show with, I wanted to tell you guys a little bit about FanDuel. Unless you live under a rock, you've probably heard of FanDuel before. And if you've ever wanted to try it but didn't really know how, here's what it's all about. FanDuel is a leader in one-week fantasy football with more winners and more payouts than any other site. They will pay out over $75 million a week this football season. We all love fantasy football, but a lot of fans miss out because the whole season is just too much of a time commitment, or your players get injured and your team sucks, which happens to me every year. FanDuel does away with all that frustration. You can draft a team anytime and drop into tournaments for weekly cash prizes. Entry fees start at $1, so there's a league for everyone. Over 1 million players have won money playing fantasy sports on FanDuel, and now it's your turn. Go to FanDuel.com. Click on the microphone in the upper right-hand corner, use the code THEMMQB, and sign up now. There's a special offer for new users. For every dollar you deposit, FanDuel will match it with up to $200 it gets earned as you play. That's a bonus of up to $200. The offer is only good for the first 50 people that use the code THEMMQB today, so don't get left out. FanDuel.com, where every day is a new season. Try it out today. At the risk of an awkward segue here, I have to tell you guys that we'll be writing a all-encompassing story about FanDuel. It's going to be on the site Thursday, so check it out over the weekend, and we will be addressing a current scandal that is rocking the daily fantasy industry and could have an impact on that for years to come.
Yeah, the daily fantasy industry as a whole, as we understand it, multiple companies.
Yeah. So your Twitter questions for today, Edward, Ed_III. So I guess that's Ed the Third?
Yeah, or Ed_III. I doubt the underscore is part of the official name, though. And guys that have these triple I's at the end tend to be pretty official.
Well, Ed asks to hear your breakdown of Washington's 90-yard game-winning drive over the weekend.
Yeah, it was that drive, it was well executed. It was really a culmination of how that whole game shook out. Washington ran effectively on the drive. Actually, the most effective they've run all game. That was the one difference, was their running game did come to life. But they kept Kirk Cousins ahead in the down and distance. We talked about that a second ago. They also did a good job of giving Cousins defined reads, stack releases, shallow crossing routes, misdirection, things that have an either-or element to them, and things that keep the ball within 10 yards downfield. Cousins did not press the ball downfield unless it was by specific zone-beating designs. So there was a leash on him, in other words, and Cousins, to his credit, responded extremely well. And that throw he made to Pierre Garçon to win the game was a big-time red zone highlight throw, the type of throw you have to make in the tight red zone if you want the difference between winning and losing. Interestingly, he also had a near interception, or one that could have very well been a few plays earlier, misreading the coverage. It's funny how those things can get lost, though. The plays that don't happen are just as important to coaches in analyzing these guys, but from afar, people that are just watching the game, they're so easy to forget about.
Yeah. I'm sure Colt McCoy wouldn't even have let it get that close. Coach,
I'm not convinced that McCoy is still not going to get that job at some point. Cousins is coming off a very good game, but let's not forget the week before against the Giants, he had another one of his, you know, meltdown games. If he's put into positions where he's throwing the ball on his own volition downfield at the intermediate levels, there's a recklessness to him, a lack of consistency, a lack of accuracy. I'm just, you know, let's not get carried away and think Cousins won that game. He played very well. He did his part. But Washington's a balanced offense. Their QB needs to be a puzzle piece.
Coach Juice has our last Twitter question at I'm a burnout?
Yeah. Well, it says burnout.
I'm a burnout.
U-R-N-O-T. Coach, I now realize sounds a lot like my last name.
Coach Juice asks, Super Troopers or Old School? Andy, have you seen both of these movies?
Yeah, and our researcher John Daigle kindly puts in parentheses, no doubt Andy has seen neither of these on this outline.
But you've seen both, haven't you?
I have seen both, yes. And I would answer Old School.
See, that's a mistake. And
I knew it. I knew you would not agree with me no matter what direction I went on.
That's not true. If you had said Super Troopers, I would have been all about it. I mean, it's a cult classic. I think it's a huge mistake that they're remaking it, meow. And some of the jokes are just so enduring. I think of a Super Troopers joke every day, but I have to struggle to go back and think of some Old School lines. I mean, that movie is overshadowed by all the other funny one-liner movies that Will Ferrell makes.
I don't disagree with that. I liked Snoop Dogg's role in Old School. I liked where Will Ferrell, before he went streaky, when he just could not control himself drinking at a party, resisting the temptation to drink at a party, very immature. I just enjoyed it. keep in mind, though, I think I was also in high school at the time. There's a different perception on this stuff when you're in high school.
That's true. Meow, we like to finish the show with our recommended reading. I'm sorry, our non-football recommended reading. Andy, are you currently working on a book or have you finished a big article that you feel the listeners need to know about?
I finished a book this week called Cold Spring Harbor by Richard Yates. And anyone who listened to the podcast last year knows that I think Richard Yates is probably the best writer of all time.
Okay. Well, I like to pick articles because I don't have the attention span for most books.
this was a short book, a fast read, by the way. But okay. I hear you.
Okay. Greg Howard, my friend at Deadspin.com, an excellent long-form writer, if long-winded, comes out with a piece this week called How ESPN's Fear of the Truth Defeated Black Grantland. Grantland being Bill Simmons' site and ESPN announcing a couple of years ago that they would launch a similar vehicle headed up by Jason Whitlock. But the article basically goes into the notion that some of the ideas that were going to come out of that site got a little bit too radical for the ESPN establishment. Really well done, really well reported and researched. So congratulations to Greg on a bunch of scoops in that story. That's how we'll end the MMQB podcast. Please tweet us using the hashtag MMQB podcast. Thanks to our producers, Alex Abnos and Dan Bloom, and our researcher extraordinaire, John Daigle. Until next week, I'm Robert Klimko. That's Andy Benoit. Have a good night. Meow.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.